From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Global warming and national security. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Despite a Republican boycott, Democrats today jammed a cap-and-trade climate change bill through a Senate committee. With just a month till a conference in Copenhagen, they wanted to show the world that Congress is ready for action on global warming. Republicans and some Democrats are worried about the cost of mandatory limits on heat-trapping gases, so supporters have raised a new question. Do melting ice caps, violent storms, rising sea levels, and drought threaten global stability and America's national security? On Reporter's Notebook later on, David Plouffe, the political genius behind the Obama campaign. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Alney back with To the Point. Nobody doubts that dealing with global warming will be expensive, so supporters of climate change legislation are raising questions of national security. Is that a diversionary tactic, or will climate change increase terrorism, force mass migration, and destabilize entire regions? On Reporter's Notebook, we'll ask David Plouffe, the man credited with running a perfect campaign for Barack Obama, what happened on Tuesday? First, this news update. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas told his allies yesterday he would not run for re-election. The King of Jordan and the presidents of Egypt and Israel called and urged him to reconsider. Abbas announced his final decision today in Ramallah. Howard Schneider is Jerusalem bureau chief for The Washington Post. And Howard, it's good to have you back on our program.
Hi, how are you again?
Good, thank you. President Abbas was scheduled to make a speech. What did he say?
Well, you know, he said what people over the last couple of days have been speculating, sort of. He said that he did not want to run for re-election. He did not say emphatically that he will not run. He did not say that I'm retiring, I'm resigning, I'm tired, I've had enough. He didn't say any of these things. In fact, what he did was sort of make a speech kind of setting the tone. Things aren't going well. We're not making progress. Then he had a little bit of criticism of the United States for not being tougher with the Israelis. He had quite a lot of criticism for the Israelis. He had a tremendous amount of criticism for Hamas, his rivals that run the Gaza Strip. And then he laid out a series of conditions, a series of reference points that he felt would still allow a two-state solution, a Palestine and Israel living side by side, to arise. And use that as a lead into the statement that, you know what, we got to take care of our housekeeping. We have elections coming up in January, and I don't want to participate.
Now, late last month, it's my understanding, he threatened to not to run again, told Secretary of State Hillary Clinton he wouldn't. President Obama called him, and he said, well, maybe he'd get back on board. Is this a political strategy on his part?
You know, it remains to be seen. I think it's kind of a keeping options open and using what leverage he has sort of strategy. This conversation's been going on. It's kind of been a slow bleed out there in Ramallah. You know, there have been a series of missteps he's made, really in consultation with the Americans, including an early disavowal of this UN war crimes investigation of Israel, which was hugely unpopular domestically for him. And now he's trying to recover. So it's almost as if he's kind of putting himself on the line and saying, listen, if you guys want me, you got to do something to help me out here. I cannot manage the way it's going on. I'm not going to run unless, you know, X, Y, and Z take place. And then he's laid out all these conditions. Basically, you know, the settlement freeze, the terms of reference, discussion of a Palestinian state on the borders that existed before the 1967 war, that sort of thing.
Is it conceivable that there might not even be an election in January?
It is quite likely that there will not be an election in January, and that's the other thing that's kind of confounding about his statement today, because he's essentially saying he's not going to run an election that probably won't take place anyway. Hamas has said very clearly they are not going to allow a vote in the Gaza Strip. They don't want an election to take place until there is some arrangement to sort of reintegrate them into Palestinian political life. And that's not going to happen until they meet the conditions of nonviolence and recognition of Israel that Israel and the international community have set for them. So it's really in a standoff. It was kind of a two-way standoff beforehand, maybe, and now it's a three- or four-way standoff. If you know, if Abbas pulls out, indeed, resigns and leaves in January, well, then the control of Fatah is up for grabs. The control of the PLO is up for grabs. It becomes a much more sort of unstable and fractious situation, and you probably have a very deep debate about Palestinian political strategy at that point. Do we continue negotiating? Do we go back to Intifada? Do we find some other violent alternative? Do we, call it a day, give up on the Palestinian state, and, demand that the Israelis let us vote in the Knesset elections, which is another option people discuss, a binational single state.
Why won't Hamas allow voting in January in Gaza? They won the last election.
Well, but they won't be allowed to campaign in the West Bank. That's the problem. They do not see that they would be allowed to actually function as a political party in half of Palestinian society.
Well, what about the possibility of the Israelis changing their position? Hillary Clinton got into trouble, of course, with the Arabs by saying that President Netanyahu had made unprecedented concessions. Others didn't agree with that. She had to back off. Would we expect anything because of what Abbas is saying from Netanyahu?
I don't quite see that happening, because if you follow the Netanyahu administration's logic and their rhetoric, part of what they feel they are trying to do is get Palestinian society, however you want to define that, to make a choice. In other words, they don't want to have kind of a what they would consider a half-baked solution of a weak Palestinian state. They want an end of conflict. That's why they talk about things like recognition of Israel, not just as a state, but as a Jewish state, as a state for the Jewish people. So, in a sense, if the Abbas regime, if the Abbas administration is collapsing, one could well see the Netanyahu people saying, well, let's see what happens next. This guy is 74 years old. They're going to have to go through a generational change of leadership. Anyway, let it happen on our watch, and we'll see what emerges. Why should we cut a deal with this guy when he's going to bow out anyway at some point?
Howard Schneider, Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the Washington Post, many thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, global warming and national security on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Senate Republicans have delayed for days a committee vote on climate change, so today Democrats passed it without them. Chairwoman Barbara Boxer of California said the Republican demand was duplicative and a waste of taxpayer dollars. In advance of next month's global warming conference in Copenhagen, she and other supporters want to send the message that the Senate will act on the issue. Darren Samuelson is senior reporter for Environment and Energy Daily. And Darren, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me back.
What other signs are there that the Senate might act? And is this, in fact, a move that will increase that possibility or make it less likely?
Well, this was a key step in the process. It was probably one of the very first steps that needed to be done in the Senate. I mean, we had a House-passed bill earlier this year that's sort of hanging out there since July 4th. And so we had one committee today in the Senate moving the bill forward. This is going to be a six-committee process. There's basically the Environment Committee today, and then the Energy Committee a couple of months ago passed its bill. But then we're going to see this move through an Agriculture Committee. We're going to see it move through the big Chief Tax Writing Committee. And then Harry Reid, the majority leader of the Senate, is ultimately going to cobble these bills together. And he's got a couple of lieutenants who have come forward, John Kerry from Massachusetts. We have Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, and Joe Lieberman from Connecticut, held a press conference yesterday to sort of talk about the process going forward and how they're working with the Obama administration. So, yeah, this is not going away anytime soon.
How problematic has this been for Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina?
Well, he stepped out about a month ago with John Kerry in an editorial in the New York Times that they co-authored, and he heard it from a lot of out-of-state energy interests. But Lindsey Graham represents sort of the moderate Republican voice, and he's not up for re-election until 2014, so he's kind of safe in terms of stepping out and doing this. He is a Republican who often has sort of marched to a different drummer in terms of the Senate. He's spoken out against Glenn Beck. He worked with the Democrats on immigration. So he's someone who has repeatedly tried to work across party lines on different issues. And here he has, the backing. I've talked to the South Carolina Chamber of Commerce. They stand behind him. A lot of the other big industries in South Carolina, Alcoa, some of the textile industries are behind Lindsey Graham as he does this. He's also hearing it, though, from the oil and gas industry.
The oil and gas industry, obviously, principal opponent of the global warming bill. What are the prospects of actually getting some legislation out of the Senate before the Copenhagen conference?
I don't think that anybody thinks that a bill is going to pass before the Copenhagen negotiations, which start in about 4 weeks. That would be impossible, and there's no effort really to do that. Everything has been about health care here in the Senate for the last many months, and the oxygen has really been sucked out of the room as reporters. You know, we're struggling just to get senators to answer questions about climate change when health care is sort of the dominant issue. So basically, this is all happening behind the scenes, and really there's been a recognition that this is something for early next year that the Senate, you know, they'll try and take an effort at trying to get 60 votes on this bill. They don't have 60 right now. My count has them at about 45. And to get those final, 15, 16, 17, 18, they're going to have to do some serious wheeling and dealing on a whole host of issues.
60 votes, of course, needed to prevent a filibuster. And has a filibuster actually been threatened? Is that a given that if they think they have the votes, they'll try to stop it that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's a given on any controversial piece of legislation these days in the Senate that a filibuster is basically spoken, even though maybe there won't actually be the, what we all know of as a filibuster of a senator standing on the floor talking, for days on end. But yeah, you need 60 votes to pass a bill in the Senate. And, there are 60 Democrats in the Senate, but I think you can probably count about four or so of them probably definitely not going to play on this bill. I'm talking about Mary Landrieu from Louisiana, Ben Nelson from Nebraska, and probably the two Dakota Democrats, Kent Conrad and Byron Dorgan, have repeatedly sounded pretty pessimistic about this bill. That means you need to win over a couple of Republicans, and those Republicans most likely would be starting with the two main Republicans who are big players in the healthcare debate as well, Olympia Snow and Susan Collins. And then Lindsey Graham comes back to mind as one of those Republicans, and then you start to go down the list from there. John McCain obviously jumps out as someone who, potentially could be someone to get this across the finish line.
And on the other side, familiar name, Max Baucus of Montana was on Barbara Boxer's committee. He's the only Democrat that did not vote for the bill this morning.
That's true. Yeah, he was the only one. It was an 11-1 vote, and I'll tell you a little bit of news that just happened in the last couple of hours. We cornered Max Baucus in the hallway and talked to him about it. He's going to start hearings next week in the Senate Finance Committee on his bill. He's actually been holding hearings earlier this year before he got absorbed in healthcare, but he's planning, to go ahead starting on Tuesday with another round of hearings on the economic and job implications of this bill, and he's going to rewrite significant portions of the bill in terms of how companies can comply with the greenhouse gas levels. One of the amendments that he wanted to offer in the Environment Committee that he couldn't offer because of the Republican boycott would have actually watered down that emissions target that we would be setting for 2020. The bill right now, the Boxer bill, is 20% by 2020, and Baucus had suggested going as low as 14%, and he just told us in the last hour that he says that Senate bill is going to get lowered, and you need Max Baucus's vote, and Max Baucus also probably represents about 10 or 12 centrist Democrats from coal states and industry states that are going to be pushing hard to water down this bill.
And the concern about the greenhouse gas levels is primarily economic.
That is the main opposition point from the Republicans, yeah, that this bill is going to cost too much. That was the reason why they boycotted all week, was they wanted additional U.S. EPA analysis of the bill that put different assumptions into the models that were a little bit more pessimistic about what kind of energy technologies would be available out in the next many decades. The price that the Obama administration has estimated for this bill is, it costs about $120 per American family per year, and that's basically after you talk about all of the different redistributions and cashback rebates that you would get and energy savings that you would get as this bill worked its way, through the economy. It would presumably, you would be using less energy, you would be using more efficient energy. There's definitely going to be some immediate benefit, some economic hits, though, for sure, on the heavy industries of the country, the coal industry as well.
Now the Democrats, or some Democrats at least, have raised the issue of national security, and Barbara Boxer held a hearing about that. We're going to spend most of our program talking about that. Tell us how that came up, what sorts of issues were raised in that hearing.
Sure. This is an issue actually that's been going on for about 2 or 3 years that has just sort of been lingering in the background. As a lot of you have had retired military generals, Senator John Warner, the former Armed Services Committee chairman from Virginia, Republican, has been really taking the lead on this. And basically the point being that, on a number of levels. One, global instability. With global warming, the most impoverished countries of the world, potentially the terrorist hotbeds, are going to get more, the climate is not going to get any more friendly in those parts of the world, which, breeds terrorists, they say. That you're also talking about migration of human patterns here, basically, that, people are going to be leaving countries and spilling over into other countries. So it sort of it crosses over into the immigration debate. And all of these pieces, I guess, water scarcity is another element of this as we look in the heavily populated Himalayan region. You kind of combine all of these issues, and it's another layer to this debate. And politically, it's one that the Democrats hope will sell in a way that maybe global warming hasn't necessarily been able to sell to the American public, is to sort of wrap this up in Homeland Security, national security. And John Kerry, who's a lead advocate of this bill, they see him as someone who's able to do that with his military background and his history, as opposed to Barbara Boxer, who's maybe not seen in the same way.
And when the military people speak on this, have they done research? Have the intelligence people been heard from?
Sure, absolutely. And that's actually been happening more and more in the intelligence community and the defense community, where they're factoring climate change and global warming into their long-term planning and intelligence briefings. It's a factor that has kind of emerged in the last, like I said, 2 or 3 years. There have been efforts here in Congress a couple of years ago to really force climate change to be considered when these intelligence briefings are done, and that, has sort of happened here. So, we also, another thing I can recall is Senator Dianne Feinstein from California talking about satellite imagery that she's able to now look at that sort of overlaps the national security implications and the melting sea ice. It's a fascinating subject when you start to broaden it out to this level.
It is, and we're going to broaden it out and have more conversation about it as we go on today. In the meantime, Darren Samuelson, thanks a lot for getting us off to a great start.
Happy to do it.
Senior reporter for Environment and Energy Daily. First, let's go to somebody who has some doubts about this, James Carafano, who is Senior Research Fellow for Defense and Homeland Security at the Heritage Foundation, conservative organization, of course. He is a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, served for 25 years. James Carafano, it's good to have you on our program.
It's good to be with you.
You've raised an interesting issue with regard to this, that we have, on the one hand, economic concerns that are relatively short-term and national security concerns that are relatively long-term. Tell us why we should be focused more on what happens immediately than what's going to happen next.
Well, that's not exactly correct. I mean, I do think that there are national security implications in the short term, and I think we should focus on those as well. So the issue that I'm most concerned about is the very simple argument that we need to pass a cap-and-trade legislation, because if we don't, the long-term implications of that is that there's going to be a lot more wars, a lot more violence, a lot more political instability. And I think it's unquestionable that the global climate is changing, that is going to be the result of that, and that may happen, but that's quite honestly a subjective judgment. And these many reports, both put out inside and outside the government, are merely that. They take one factor and they project it into the future. I mean, if you really look at this, you're combining three incredibly complex systems: weather and global climate, which we know is incredibly complex, how humans interact with our environment, which is almost infinitely complex, and energy markets, which is a very, very complex system. And you're combining them into all together into one and making one projection. And, people that really do this business, this is called a complex system, a nonlinear system, where every variable affects every other variable. They will tell you that you can build a system like that, but the notion that you could make anything that looks remotely like an accurate long-term projection is just not feasible. It's just very, very subjective. I point to, for example, Jared Diamond's wonderful book on collapse, in which he looks back at how societies in the past failed to deal with changes in their environment and in some way accelerated them and introduced their own demise. Well, Diamond introduces 12 variables to explain this, and he can only show how they all interrelate based on over 100 years of history and archaeological studies. So the notion that you could project that into the future in human environments that are very, very different, it's just very, very unrealistic. I mean, if we actually look at the world today, I mean, the global climate's been changing for a while, no question about that. Some of these issues have been very prominent for a while. You've got a folk just coming on from the Woodrow Wilson Center who've actually been a real pioneer at looking at this issue. Water scarcity is not a new issue. Climate change in different areas is not a new issue. But actually, when you look aggregately right now at the global systems and some very reputable studies, including those by the Human Security Research Project in Canada, over the last 20 years, levels of political violence and death from political violence due to wars, terrorism, even accounting for Al-Qaeda and Iraq and Afghanistan and the Sudan, are on the decline. So that correlation isn't actually even there right now.
Does that become an argument against the cap-and-trade bill?
Well, I think what we have to judge the cap-and-trade bill is not on a future that somebody projects 50 years from now, because the point is nobody can accurately project that future, how humans are going to respond to the environment, the kind of changes they're going to make to adapt and to make the environment better. You just can't do it. I mean, I'm sorry, I wish we could, but we can't. So we have to look at what are the impacts in the near term. And so when I hear people say that this is a bill that could cost a million plus jobs, that could shave points of our domestic growth, that has immediate national security implications. I mean, defense spending is already, our military is already under stress. Our defense spending is actually going to go down. If our economy goes down, we'll spend even less on defense. That's a problem. If the American economy goes down, that's going to have a cascading effect and accelerate the global recession. That will lead to additional instability. So, I mean, I think these factors have to be weighed. Well, and we have to do a cost-benefit analysis. At the end of the day, how much we have to answer the question is, how much damage are we going to do the American economy? How's that going to affect our security and global stability? And how much reduction in greenhouse gases are we actually going to make for that? So that properly is the discussion. These notions about 50 years in the future, if we don't pass this bill, that we're going to have mass migration, that is literally unknowable. And when you look at the studies, you don't actually see rigorous scientific or analytical methodologies that really make a compelling case.
James Carafano, once again, Senior Research Fellow for Defense and Homeland Security at the Heritage Foundation, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel after 25 years of service. We just have about a minute left before we go to our break. I want to introduce our next guest, Jeffrey DeBelko, who is Director of the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Not much room left until we come back after our break for more than a topic sentence, but how would you respond in a general way to what we just heard from James Carafano?
Thanks, Warren. I think the Colonel has it exactly right that highly complex systems, and so in that sense, if the climate and security case that's being made is climate is going to cause war, therefore pass a bill, that's a problem. But I think there's a way to make a case that reflects that complexity and still shows that there are an awful lot of ways that these links are meaningful that we need to take on and take seriously from a risk analysis and a probabilistic perspective rather than a certainty perspective.
And are those then arguments in favor of the cap-and-trade bill that the Senate and the Congress are looking at?
Well, I think for some that may be the conclusion that's drawn, but I guess I would urge us to look beyond seeing this as just a political football in a particular year of trying to get this legislation done, albeit a really important year.
All right. An important year will be next year, we do have time to kick these ideas around. We'll come back with our first two guests and another one as well on our Reporter's Notebook later. David Plouffe, who ran the Obama campaign, is the president keeping his promises? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point, talking about global warming and national security today. Can we base legislation on projections that are made about extraordinarily complex issues that won't take or events, I should say, that won't take place until well into the future? What about the more immediate consequences to the economy of the kinds of proposals that are being made to deal with global warming? Back to Jeffrey DeBelko at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Go ahead and tell us, if you will, how you think we can reconcile the kinds of problems James Carafano outlined.
Well, I think in some respects, I would challenge the notion that we're talking only about things that are going to show up in 2050. For starters, we need to act now to avert challenges that occur that far out in advance just because of momentum in the system. But, I mean, if we're talking, for example, about the changes in Arctic sea ice and how we're going to see, and already do see, periods of the year where the shipping lanes are essentially entirely different, raising whole questions about sovereignty and who controls that, whether those are open seas or Canadian territorial waters, and with the suspicion that there are an awful lot of rich resources that are going to be accessible. It's not, I don't think, particularly likely to have shootouts in the far north. But nevertheless, if you're a security planner and you're about making procurement decisions in the Navy and trying to understand what it's going to be like in terms of that new reality from a commercial and a security perspective, then that's a legitimate issue to put climate change and security together. If you're concerned with here at home, energy security and the security of supply, then the fact that big parts of our delivery system for petroleum, whether it's in Alaska or Canada or Russia, where those pipelines are built on permafrost, it's not going to stay frozen, then that's something that, again, is not a point of a gun issue, but one that I think we can agree in many respects is part of a security risk analysis perspective that has to be taken into account. And then I would say, and then of course, further focusing here at home, while we don't want to make the mistake of attributing a specific storm to climate change such as the Katrina effect, in a warmer world, we're likely to face at least more intense, if not more frequent, sets of storms that will test the urban infrastructure that is on our coasts, as well as then the droughts that are internal that we're seeing that are, again, if we want to talk economic costs, we need to start seeing those as some of the alternatives and opportunity costs to some of the short-term costs that we're talking about. And then finally, on the conflict dimension, as I said, I think the Colonel is right to stress the complexity of social conflict, whether it's overtly violent or more structural around the kind of poor conditions and poverty and lack of livelihoods. I think the operative notion in understanding climate change is that it's going to be a threat multiplier. It's not going to create a new class of warfare, and necessarily warfare in a whole bunch of places that hasn't been aren't violent neighborhoods already in many respects. But I think what it's going to do is it's going to exacerbate and put additional pressures on some of the underlying conditions that we do see correlating with instability, we'll say, that it's going to make it harder for some of those fragile states to have the capacity, have the perceived legitimacy of their populations, and to find ways to employ what we need to remember that in some of these areas, South Asia, Horn of Africa, are still relatively rapidly growing populations. And so in that respect, I think we would make a mistake to overstate the case and say that we're going to have a new class of warfare and necessarily even a new class of migrants because people move for multiple reasons. But the flip side is that we would be silly to ignore this long-term stress that is having, in some cases, folks argue, current impacts on water, on agriculture, on land, through loss of land through deforestation, that are really relevant in some above-the-fold countries that are direct security concerns already.
But I think we heard earlier that this is being used as an argument for the cap-and-trade bill that's passed the House in one version and is now being looked at by six different committees in the Senate. Are what you just said arguments for cap-and-trade?
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily. Well, cap and trade is what we're dealing with. I think there are multiple ways to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, and I think this is less an argument about endorsing one of those methods, that rather than in the words of former General Zinni, who was one of these retired four stars who participated in these process, said, this is not a call for the military to adopt climate change as its first, second, or third priority, or even to be the lead actor. It needs to be in a supporting role. But in this case, it's most saliently urging civilians to get serious about mitigation as well as adaptation, to get serious at mitigation, because if not, then some of these problems ultimately are going to be more expensive to deal with and are going to end up manifesting themselves in ways that does come to the military being asked to address in increased number and severity of humanitarian missions, which given the deployments now are increasingly difficult to do, but of course we're called on to, the U.S. military is often called upon to do, as well as the ones where they're kind of the whole questions of ungoverned spaces and unstable countries where we are concerned about the ability to recruit and train extremist groups and fundamentalist groups. So in that respect, Yes, it's an argument for getting serious on mitigation. How that's done is a kind of a finer political point, and I think the case for legislation is not dependent on the security argument, but it's an additional argument for taking aggressive action.
Jeffrey DeBelko, once again, Director of Environmental Change and Security at the Woodrow Wilson Center. We'll come back to him and to James Carafano with the Heritage Foundation as well. First, though, let me introduce Stephen Ferris. He is a freelance foreign correspondent. He's author of Forecast, The Surprising and Immediate Consequences of Climate Change. And Stephen Ferris, good to have you on our program.
Hey, thank you.
Maybe you can elaborate a bit on what we've just heard from Jeffrey DeBelko in the sense that you have traveled around the world. You've looked at some of the changes that are already happening. He's referred to a few of them. How could global warming, for example, affect the relationship between two nuclear powers, India and Pakistan?
Sure. That's one of the examples I looked at. It's a little bit complex, if you bear with me. But essentially what you have there is you've got the two countries, India and Pakistan, have a problem in Kashmir. And usually we look at that conflict and we think about it as being a religious conflict. But there's kind of a second underlying cause of the conflict, and that's water. Pakistan in particular relies on, I think it's about 90% of its agricultural irrigation comes from the waters that flow through Kashmir. Now, about 50 years ago, the two countries, soon after they split, carved out an agreement, and basically they said half the water, these three rivers go to India, these three rivers go to Pakistan. And more or less, while we agree to disagree, we continue to fight these small wars over Kashmir, we're still going to maintain that status quo. And that's actually has gone on. It's called the Indus Water Treaty, and it's often pointed to as an example of how kind of resource scarcity can lead to cooperation rather than conflict between two countries, because you've got two countries are fighting wars, but at the same time they're maintaining this status quo. But the problem is that status quo, as I've kind of tried to explore in my book, is dependent on the water that flows, on the ice freezing. And now we're the latest projections, I think around 2035, the Himalayas are the glaciers are going to be basically gone. So now when that water that nowadays falls in the winter time and freezes and then is kind of slowly released naturally when the summer comes in time for the planting, well, now that water is already starting to happen. When I was in Kashmir, they were telling me that they're getting these terrible floods, that the water's levels are dropping, that a lot of their springs are drying out. And what's happening is the water is already starting to flow more often in the winter than it does in the summer. Now, normally the solution is to take a natural water storage like glaciers and replace it with man-made water storage like dams. But the problem here is that those dams, the only really place you can build them in that region is Kashmir, which India controls, the Pakistan disputes. So kind of the idea that I went and explored in my book is, well, what situation will that put Pakistan in the next 20, 30 years? It's already severely water stressed. It's got a high population, little amounts of water. It's watching its water resources dwindle. So Pakistan kind of gets put in a situation where it's got to make one of three, from its perspective, very bad choices. It can either, do nothing and try to either let its people starve or import grain from somewhere else. It can allow the Indians to build dams and within Kashmir, kind of handing over control of the water to its country it regards as its enemy, or it can, be pushed to try to escalate that conflict, accelerate the insurgency. It can't win a conventional war against India, but what it could do is try to push that insurgency up, try to weaken India's resolve without kind of tipping the scale into kind of full-scale conventional or nuclear warfare. So it's just one example of how the status quo that we've built our society on is changing because of climate change, and that has the potential to kind of tip us over into a place we don't necessarily want to go.
And there are other parts of the world where similar kinds of things are—I shouldn't say similar—they're all different, as we've already observed. This is an enormously complex subject, but there are other places where these kinds of problems might be exacerbated by, and undoubtedly will be exacerbated by, climate change. But what about legislation here in the United States or around the world, for that matter? What sort of legislation could prevent these things from happening?
The solution, is what we're talking about here in December in Copenhagen, which is to find some way to band the world together and agree to stop putting this carbon dioxide in the air. If you can, if you think about what's the solution to the melting glaciers in Pakistan, well, we can either invest in the future and in terms of mediation between the two countries, in terms of perhaps recovering from a nuclear war or a conventional war, or dealing with the refugee crisis because of whatever happens in Kashmir, or we can try to invest now in terms of cutting down our carbon. If the stability in Kashmir, if we at least buy that argument for the moment, if the stability in Kashmir depends on the glaciers not melting or on the glaciers being there, well, perhaps one of the cheapest ways of fixing that is to do our best to make sure that the glaciers don't disappear. And of course, that's just one example, and you've got that different possibilities for maybe not nuclear conflict, but other parts of other troubles all over the world, okay, that you're also preventing by dealing with the problem now rather than later.
Again, Stefan Ferris, a freelance correspondent, his book, Forecast, The Surprising and Immediate Consequences of Climate Change. Let me go back to James Carafano at the Defense and Homeland Security, or who's a fellow for Defense and Homeland Security at the Heritage Foundation. If, in fact, even if the accuracy of these kinds of predictions is questionable, something's going to certainly happen as a result of climate change. Doesn't it then make sense to do something now to try to prevent carbon dioxide from making things worse than they would be otherwise?
Well, of course, the one thing you don't want to do is feel the pressure to make a decision and make a decision that actually makes things worse. I mean, we can't really discuss what is the impact that the Global Climate Change Treaty is going to have, because we don't have a treaty yet, and I don't think anybody thinks that one's going to come out of Copenhagen. So until we have a treaty and actually see what's in it, it's very difficult to say, is this going to make things better or not? I mean, I think there are legitimate concerns that the cap-and-trade bill, I agree with all of the environmental concerns just raised, the cap-and-trade bill is not going to affect global emissions significantly, so it's not going to ameliorate that at all. And I think there are very legitimate concerns about the economic consequences, both the United States and the globe, which would actually make it much, much more difficult to deal with these issues and actually exacerbate the severity of the issues because of the inability to deal with them. So I think those are legitimate concerns. And I think, the fundamental narrative is we have to stop this or things are going to get worse. For example, the Arctic's a great situation. The weather in the Arctic's getting better. I mean, it kind of runs counter to the narrative. I mean, the problem.
Well,
better
for shipping.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem. Well, better for for a lot of things. Well, it's changing. I mean, global environment always changes. So the answer in the Arctic, how do you prevent wars and resource wars in the Arctic? May be as simple as buying some more ice cutters and fielding a little more robust Coast Guard. You don't need a cap and trade bill to that. Even if we could eliminate carbon emissions tomorrow and we stopped global warming, we wouldn't stop climate change, and we wouldn't stop significant regional crises and environmental stresses because of human influences, because of other natural influences. This notion that somehow we're going to do something and we're going to eliminate this problem, it's just not true. In some cases, global climate change, in some parts of the world, things are going to get better. In some places, things are going to get worse. Should we try to prevent serious long-term effects? Absolutely. Should we be a good steward of the environment? I totally agree. But the question, I think the proper question is will this bill make the global environment significantly better? And are the consequences of the bill in our ability to deal with the environment, are the benefits, are the costs not too high? I think that's a legitimate question.
Okay, Jeffrey DeBelko, back to you with the Woodrow Wilson Center. What do you say to that? Can you answer that question in a way that you said earlier that the cap and trade bill is only one of the ways of trying to mitigate the problem of global warming? But what about the prospect of passing a bill that actually makes things worse, and particularly one before there's an international treaty, and you don't know what the terms of it are?
Yeah, well, I think because one bill, and in fact, there's no bill in any given country that standing alone is going to solve this problem. But in one respect, this is the United States taking aggressive steps to show its commitment in addressing mitigation, particularly given historic responsibility of developed countries causing this problem, is, I think, a prerequisite to the rest of the world, which we are dependent on with this situation, to taking aggressive steps as well. And so we can point to other countries that were not formally obliged under the Kyoto Protocol, like China and India and Brazil and such, and say, well, they need to go first. But in fact, we've committed committed to going first ourselves, and we have the historical record of creating the problem. And so I don't think it's unreasonable for the world to expect us to take significant action, which, of course, is best represented by congressional action, in going forward, knowing that no one country's bill is going to solve this problem. We have to all do it. We have to all do it together.
Let me go back to Stephen Ferris. Do you think the United States has some special obligation to go first? And if so, would that justify running the risk that James Carafano points to, which would be the one of making things worse rather than making them better?
I don't know if we have an obligation to go first, but nothing's going to happen if we don't. I mean, the world, I was just actually recently in Copenhagen about 10 days ago, and it was kind of a pre-meeting to the big meeting later on this time where they are trying to carve out. And it was very clear the countries are watching us very carefully. They expect us to take a leadership role, both for historical reasons. We've gotten rich off of burning fossil fuels, and also for the fact that we are one of the largest emitters. And we're one of the richest countries in the world, and we have this special role that we've, you know, both has both been thrust upon us and that we've chosen to take of being the global leader. So it's very true that one bill, our bill, is not going to solve the problem by itself, but it is going to be has the potential of being the first move that opens up the floodgates and lets everybody else get on board as well. It's certainly the case that nobody's going to do anything else if we're sitting on the sidelines and saying, please, you other guys go first.
Well, we heard at the beginning of this program that the Copenhagen Treaty will meeting will have been passed before there's any chance of anything happening here in the United States. So does that argue then for being more cautious, for taking a longer look at what we're doing, and particularly at the cap-and-trade bill, which has a lot of disadvantages, as James Carafano pointed out?
Well, you've got a chicken and the egg approach here with climate legislation. I mean, the kind of treaty is waiting for the United States, but at the same time, the Senate especially is not going to pass anything, especially in terms of the treaty, until other countries are on board. So we need to take it's like any type of, you know, trying to resolve any type of complex problem. You got to take this little steps at a time. So if Copenhagen doesn't come up with a full treaty, well, it's certainly going to help if we start to have legislation in place, and that's going to help other people get on board and realize, hey, these guys are looking like they're serious, and we have the chance of doing something. We should start doing something as well, which will then let us, once again, go back and say, well, are we really doing enough, or do we need to do something more serious to really take care of this problem? Because it does seem to be a consensus now that this is a problem we do need to address. Exactly how and to what pace and everything else is still up to debate, and exactly to what level who participates in the world at what time and to what extent is still trying to be sorted out. But the world does seem to want to do this, and I think it's very clear that they're looking for the United States for leadership and responsibility.
Okay, we're going to leave it at that for the moment. Once again, to remind our listeners, one of six Senate committees now has passed a version of the cap-and-trade bill. The House of Representatives has passed one. We'll see what happens next. Thank you all for being on our program. Stephan Ferris, again, a freelance correspondent, author of Forecast, The Surprising and Immediate Consequences of Climate Change. Jeffrey DeBalco, the Director of Environmental Change and Security at the Woodrow Wilson Center. And James Carafano with the Heritage Foundation, formerly a Army Lieutenant Colonel with service of 25 years, and our earlier guest, Darren Samuelson, senior reporter for Environment and Energy Daily. When he talks about the mechanics of last year's campaign, President Obama says he couldn't have done it without David Plouffe. That's from the jacket of Plouffe's new book, The Audacity to Win. In a moment, we'll ask Plouffe, does the president have the audacity to govern? More in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. David Plouffe is often called the behind-the-scenes architect of the Obama campaign. He's kept his head low, though, by staying out of the Obama administration. Now, though, he has emerged with a book called The Audacity to Win, The Inside Story and Lessons of Barack Obama's Historic Victory. David Plouffe, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Warren. Thanks for having me.
During your book tour, it's been reported that you've been encouraging audience members to find inspiration and get active again in local politics, and particularly the young people, the blacks, the independents who voted for President Obama. Why didn't they turn out yesterday in Virginia, in New Jersey, particularly when the president asked them to?
Well, it's not that easy, of course. I mean, I think that there's a lot of hyperventilating about the results and a lot of fairly simplistic overreading of what happened. Listen, first of all, turnout in off-year elections is always going to lag presidential elections. And turning out people who don't have a long history of voting is really hard. It took us a long time, a lot of effort, a lot of focus, a lot of inspiration to them. And I think all Democratic candidates, this can't just be transferred. Every candidate for office is responsible for running their own campaign, getting folks out. We'll, of course, encourage people to do it. I think our encouragement probably helped turnout there. But I also think it's a message that, you know, we need to make sure that for these voters who tend to be cynical about politics, you know, if we deliver on health care reform, deliver on real energy progress, on financial reform, I think it's going to be a wonderful message to them that, in fact, their vote does matter, and keep them involved. So we're all going to work very, very hard at it, not just in the next election, but in the years to come.
Some of the things that you mentioned, health care reform, energy reform, I would mention reform of Wall Street and its behavior as well, are bogged down in the Congress with a lot of people saying that the president has made too many compromises and hasn't been tough enough. Do you think that some of those people that you mobilized are disappointed and feel that the promises aren't being kept?
No, listen, I think I stay in fairly close contact with our grassroots supporters. And, you know, they, in terms of what the president's done in, around the world in terms of strengthening and rebuilding our relationships, the recovery package, which has led to finally getting growth, which will help with the conditions of job creation, expanding stem cell research, we've done a lot of great things. Obviously, we have a legislative system. You can't just do these things by fiat. So we're working through it. We've made more progress on health care than at any time in the last 100 years. I think we're on the doorstep of doing something that's going to have huge impact, not just in terms of providing health care to people, but strengthening our economy. And so, you know, listen, we live in an impatient political culture. It's kind of a moment-to-moment kind of environment. The president takes a long view of things. I think we're making progress. And I think when we do make progress, this narrative about, you know, impatience will largely melt away.
Let me correct myself before we go further. I said the elections were yesterday, and of course they were on Tuesday. This is Thursday that we on which we're speaking. We didn't tape this interview in advance. Let me just let our listeners know that that is the case. What about the decision that the president has to make with regard to Afghanistan? It would seem that in some ways he's damned if he does, damned if he doesn't increase the U.S. Presence there. What would you, as a political advisor, think the consequences might be either way?
Well, I don't think politics will enter into this, nor should it. So, and I'm not involved in these discussions.
Really? Really? These decisions don't have anything to do with politics at all?
No, they don't. And if they do, there's something terribly wrong. I think I'm not involved in these discussions, and substantively, I think, though I have great confidence in his decision-making process and the types of questions he'll be asking. And, you know, he'll reach a judgment that's very well considered, and I think, you know, looks down the road to make sure all factors are being considered.
You don't think that it's a concern of the White House that it one way or the other there might be an impact on the domestic legislation or on the president's chances for reelection?
No. I think you've got to focus solely on what is the right mission and decisions to be made on something like this. And I have every confidence that's what's happening.
Why do you think it's taking so long?
I don't think it is taking too long. I think this is a kind of a strange narrative. It's one of the weightiest decisions here any president will make, and he's obviously doing a lot of discussion and a lot of analyzing and wants to make sure that he makes the best judgment in his view. And, you know, I think that, that steadiness is something that serves the country well.
Let's get back to the campaign. That's what your book is about, of course. You've said that the Obama campaign was more like chess, whereas Senator McCain was playing checkers. What do you mean by that?
Well, part of that is a reference to we went through a very tough primary with a very skilled candidate in Hillary Clinton and campaign. And, you know, we came out of that, you know, really having every day kind of faced off with them. And, you know, they're very sophisticated. And I think that
she was a chess player.
Well, yeah. I mean, certainly in sort of the day-to-day, you know, debate of the campaign, she was. I mean, I think strategically, electorally, we ended up having some advantages in terms of the delegates and how that all played out. But, yeah, they were very, very good. And, listen, the McCain campaign, you know, they did the best they could. They made some good decisions. But generally, I think one thing that surprised us was, you know, if you remember, Warren, he had a three-month head start on us because our primary dragged on. And we figured we'd come out of that primary really far behind organizationally. We thought McCain would develop an incisive message on the economy, perhaps gain some separation from President Bush. You know, none of that happened, and I think that was, from our perspective, fortunate.
Now, you've said you were offended yourself by the choice of Sarah Palin to be the vice presidential nominee of the Republican Party. What do you mean?
Well, I think that we were surprised, simply because he had spent the previous few months really hammering Barack Obama for lack of experience, particularly around foreign policy. And then he makes this pick. And I think the more we learned about the process, that it seemed to be something that was done, you know, at the last minute, you know, was bothersome.
What was offensive about it, then?
Well, I think that, listen, this is a serious selection, and I think it's very clear. I mean, listen, the McCain campaign people have told you after the election now, it was a political pick. And I don't think this pick should be politics. I think it first should be who would be the best counselor as vice president, and if something happens to you, is this the best person? So I think that the McCain campaign says, listen, we needed to do something risky, we thought, throw the long ball. And I don't think that's how that pick should be made. And by the way, what I think is less important than what the American people thought, and they clearly believe that as well.
There's a lot in the book about the choice of Senator Biden. We don't have time to go into it, and we've only got a few seconds left. But do you think Sarah Palin is still an important political force in the United States?
Well, she's got a huge following, obviously, in a certain segment of the Republican base. And, you know, she's going to be out with her book in a couple of weeks, and I'm sure it's going to be a phenomenon. So, yeah, I think she and Limbaugh and Beck and that crowd definitely have a huge say in the future of the Republican Party.
David Plouffe, The Audacity to Win, The Inside Story and Lessons of Barack Obama's Historic Victory. Many thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Karen Radziner and Katie Cooper. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point.